Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. By the time to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one on your phone and record your name. To cancel your question, you may press star followed by the number two. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Amy Fricke. You may begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Amy Fricke, one of the organizers for today's call. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webinar is FY17 Technical Assistance for Clinical Documentation. The presenters will be from the Division of Mental Health, Bureau of Community Services, Leanne Reinert, Clinical Policy Specialist, and from the Collaborative, Chris McConkie, Director of Quality Management. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful housekeeping items. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed, which is 888-469-1370, and the passcode is 3727-977. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you may choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to see the webinar PowerPoint presentation, the login information is located on the invite you received after you registered. If you are experiencing any problems with that particular link to join, you may also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the webinar ID directly. And that webinar ID is 10940051. There will be a designated question and answer portion at the end of each presentation today. The operator will open up the lines for questions at that time. And lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take less than 5 minutes to complete the survey, and we value your feedback. And now, without further ado, I would like to turn the call over to Leanne Reinert. Leanne, you may begin.
Thank you, Amy, and good afternoon, everyone. As Amy said, this is Leanne Reinert with the Division of Mental Health. I'm going to talk to you about a few things today, and then Chris will take over and will be providing you with some more concrete examples to apply the things that we talk about in the beginning here. There are a few things that I hope to accomplish in our time together. I want to make sure that it is clear what the roles and responsibilities of each of the groups on the call today are. That includes the roles and responsibilities for the Division of Mental Health, for the Collaborative, and for providers. Also want to make sure that by the time we're done today that you understand what the Rule 132 documentation requirements are and that you learn what resources are available to you if following the training today you have any further questions or need further support from us, because we want to make sure that we are there to provide you with that assistance as needed. So just we'll get right into it. First of all, the role and responsibility of the Division of Mental Health as it relates to provider monitoring. First of all, the division, as the state mental health authority, must ensure that community mental health services that are provided within the state of Illinois comply with both federal and state statutes and regulations. This is because we process through claims that you, the providers, send to us for federal match, and we are always at risk of federal audit, so we have to make sure that we are in compliance with everything that the federal government requires of us in order to get that federal money so that we don't have to pay any back. Also, we have within our state legislative mandates that also govern how we do our work here in the Division of Mental Health, and we want to always make sure that we're in compliance with all of that. Next, we use our provider monitoring as a tool to ensure that the services provided to the citizens of Illinois meet certain standards of quality care. So we do things like clinical practice guidance that is a tool to look at quality issues and provide our community mental health agencies with some feedback and technical assistance related to areas of quality. Next, we do have to make sure that we are always prudent stewards of taxpayer money. While we do get federal match on claims, there is also state budgeted money that goes into paying for mental health services, and the division is responsible for making sure that we are using all of those dollars responsibly. Finally, it is our responsibility here at the Division of Mental Health to establish all the policies and procedures related to our provider monitoring activities. So while the collaborative is very involved in doing the monitoring, they are doing that at the direction of the Division of Mental Health. Next, we'll get into how they do that just a little bit more. The role and responsibility of the collaborative, we do our provider monitoring through the Collaborative Quality Management Department, which is a department within Beacon Health Options. That is the corporate name. The Illinois Mental Health Collaborative for Access and Choice is their doing business as name in Illinois for the work that they do here for us as our administrative service organization here in Illinois. The Quality Management Department at the Collaborative does a few things related to provider monitoring. First of all, we require that each of the people that they employ to complete provider monitoring functions must be a licensed clinician, so that we know that the folks that are being sent out to your agencies do have clinical backgrounds and experience and can and have the right qualifications to provide you with good feedback related to your records, and that they fully understand what they're looking at when they look at your records. Those staff are also responsible for communicating with providers at the time that they do the visits, as well as before the visit occurs and after the visit concludes. So before the provider monitoring occurs at your agency, you will get a call from the quality department letting you know about the upcoming visit and giving you information related to that visit. Following the visit, you will get written report from the reviewers that visited you with a written summary of any findings related to your review. And then finally, from time to time, the Division of Mental Health asks the quality department at the collaborative to provide training such as this one to further help our providers if there are particular areas that we believe there needs to be a focus on. They assist us as our administrative service organization in the logistics, as well as assisting us in presenting some of the content of the training. And, of course, as providers of community mental health services defined by Rule 132, our community agencies have some responsibilities related to clinical documentation. First, it is the responsibility of each agency that gets certified to provide Rule 132 services that anyone that is providing those services is fully compliant with Rule 132, and the best way to do that is to make sure that you have read and understand all of Rule 132. It's a long rule. There are lots of pieces to it, so it takes a little bit of investment on the side of the provider to actually accomplish that understanding. Next, it is important that our providers become familiar with the monitoring tools that are used during post-payment review so that you will know what is being looked at when the collaborative comes on site, and so that you have some advanced understanding of what those expectations will be. Next, we would ask that you ask questions of us when you need to, and direct those to your regional staff. Each agency operates within a region of the state, and you have individuals employed by the state of Illinois available to you to assist you in fully understanding your obligations related to being a provider of community mental health care, and you know, contact them and ask them questions as needed. They will then, if they need to, they'll involve one of us here at central office in the division, and they can also follow up with the collaborative if needed. Next, and this one is also very important, you need to make sure that any written notices or letters that you receive from the collaborative related to provider monitoring are read completely. There is a lot of information in those letters, a lot of instruction related to any follow-up that's needed, if there are plans of improvement that are needed as a result of monitoring. All of that is spelled out in those letters, and as well as the timelines for compliance with anything that you're required to do as a result of the monitoring. So take the time to read the letter or the notice completely so that you understand it. And then again, if after you've read it, you still have questions, ask those of your regional staff, and they will either be able to assist you directly or they will find the person at central office that can. Next, you are obligated, once you start billing for Rule 132 services, to grant access to your records and make requested records available at the time of the monitoring visit. You will receive a week's notice before your provider monitoring visit occurs, and that week is to make sure that you gather any paper records that are needed, or you know, make sure that you have made all arrangements necessary so that once the collaborative reviewers get on site, they are able to get access to your records and complete that review as quickly as possible, and be as the least intrusion possible to your agency. Finally, if as a result of post-payment review, there are findings of any unsubstantiated claims in that review, it is the provider's responsibility to go into the system and void out those unsubstantiated claims within the time frame required. And that will be, again, very clearly spelled out in the notice and the letters that you receive following the review. So now we're going to move into some of the clinical responsibilities related to actually providing Rule 132 services. The first of those is the determination of medical necessity. Every Rule 132 service that is provided to an individual must be medically necessary. And that means that the LPHA that is responsible for directing the care of that individual has to have made that determination and documented it in the clinical record. There are a number of factors defined by the rule, and you'll see the site there on the slide, 132.25, that must be considered by the LPHA whenever they say, yes, this particular service is medically necessary for this particular individual. First of all, there is a definition of medical necessity. The first requirement within that definition is that the individual must have a diagnosis of a mental illness, or if they don't yet have a diagnosis and they're under the age of 21, they have to have at least two criteria of a mental illness. They must have impairment of role functioning that's related to the symptoms of that mental illness that they have the diagnosis for. And they must be in need of at least one service as a result of that limitation or impairment of role functioning that is expected to help to stabilize or restore or rehabilitate the person to a maximum level of functioning. The next factor that has to be considered by the LPHA is the type, severity, and chronicity of the person's symptoms. Also, the severity of the impairment in the person's role functioning. Any risk that the person's symptoms or level of role functioning may pose to the safety of that person or to any other individuals with whom that person may be interacting. Must consider both the short-term and long-term outcome of the service needed. Must consider progress made in response to treatment if the person has been receiving treatment prior to this determination of medical necessity occurring. And finally, the division provides additional criterion guidance for some of the Rule 132 services. And so if there is additional criteria or guidance published for the purpose of defining and evaluating medical necessity, then those criteria must also be considered as the determination for medical necessity is being made. So once all of those factors have been considered, an LPHA signs a mental health assessment and signs a treatment plan. And in doing those two things, the LPHA is affirming that those seven factors that I just reviewed have been considered, and that the LPHA believes that the treatment recommendations contained within the treatment plan are medically necessary for the individual that is going to receive the care. So this all leads us to our illustration of the golden thread. We start by assessing a need for an individual that has presented for care. And once those needs have been assessed, with the individual that is receiving care, we work to identify the goals that they would like to receive from treatment. And then we establish, together with that person, a plan for achieving those goals. The services are provided, and then we assess progress towards the goals, and we start the process over. Once we assess whether or not progress has been made, we figure out where we need to go from there, and we make modifications to our plan of care. So it's a ongoing cycle. And the idea of the golden thread is that you can follow the thread all the way through the cycle, and each piece relates to the previous pieces. So the mental health assessment is completed, and the needs are clearly identified, and it is logical what the goals would be based on what was identified in the mental health assessment. From there, it's logical that there is a plan to get to those goals. Then it is clear that that plan includes the provision of specific services, et cetera. So again, we begin the golden thread with the assessment. Within Rule 132, there is a mental health assessment service, and provision of that service then results in a mental health assessment report. Within 30 days of the first face-to-face assessment, you must complete this written mental health assessment report that then becomes a part of the individual's clinical record. This mental health assessment report is where the clinician who's been doing the assessment documents what the needs are of the individual and begins to make the case for medical necessity for whatever specific Rule 132 services that individual needs. If you need a refresher on all the areas that must be considered in the mental health assessment, I've given you the rule citation there. It's all listed at 132.148A. Once we've completed the mental health assessment, we start to identify the goals with the individual and develop a plan to get there. So again, it's very important that the individual is actively involved in the development of this plan. That is a requirement of the rule. And you must document that the person was involved in developing their treatment plan. It would be very difficult to determine someone's goals for them. So the first part is determining the goals that you want to achieve in treatment, and then, as I said, to develop a plan for treatment to get you there. The treatment plan is the clinician's opportunity to document in the record both short and long-term expectations of treatment, as well as which specific interventions are medically necessary to get to those expected outcomes of treatment. The full requirements for treatment plan development, review, and modification, which is the official name for that Rule 132 service, are also listed in the rule, and they're listed at 132-148C. I'm going to talk a little bit more about goals versus objectives. So the goal is set by the individual. It's what the individual is expecting to get out of the care that you provide. So when the individual comes into your agency, they're struggling with something and they want something to be different. So that's the goal. The objectives are something that the individual may not be able to identify on their own. That is where the clinical work comes in. It is the steps that you need to take to get to the goal. So it would therefore be logical that in order for this individual that is receiving care to identify those objectives, they might need the assistance of the clinician in identifying and defining those so that they can eventually attain the goal that they've identified. One of the areas where that has been identified through our provider monitoring, where there is sometimes confusion in Rule 132 and the different types of services that are provided, is the difference between community support and case management mental health. When we talk about the service of community support, we are talking about services where you are doing something with the individual or their collaterals, and involves things like demonstrating a skill, teaching a skill, practicing a skill, or role-playing a skill. You can see Rule 132-150E for a more legal definition of community support, but that's really kind of the essence of it, is that you're doing something with the individual and they're learning a skill or learning something as a result. So one thing might be assisting the individual in identifying interests or hobbies that then they use in some way to further their recovery. When we're talking about case management mental health, which is another Rule 132 defined service, we're talking about something that's done on behalf of the individual, linking the person with something that they need, making appointments for the person, and you're doing that because the individual lacks the ability to do it on their own and can't at the point in time, even with your assistance, do it for themselves. So you're doing it on their behalf. We would expect that over time the need for case management would probably reduce as the person moves along in their recovery, but certainly there are times in acute phases of illness or when there is a particularly difficult situation that requires some advocacy, that a person does need case management. So that service does still exist in our rule, and we do expect agencies to provide that when it is medically necessary. So one of those ways that you might be providing case management is if you need to help a person gain access to public entitlements. That can be a pretty complicated process to navigate, and you may need to do some things on behalf of the individual, as well as assisting the person in gaining access to resources outside of your own agency. So if the person needs some other type of social service assistance, you might be providing case management if they're not able to navigate that system for themselves. All right. So we're going to now follow the golden thread into service provision, and we've just talked about a couple of services there, case management and community support. So if on your treatment plan you've identified that the person needs community support or they need case management, or maybe you've identified that they need both, then you provide the service and you need to document the service. So as you document that you've provided that service, you need to clearly link the service provided back to the interventions on the treatment plan, which are connected through that golden thread to the assessed needs of the individual. The next way that you document medical necessity in your clinical record is through your mental health assessment updates. The rule requires that you update your mental health assessment at least annually, and that date is from the date that the LPHA signed the most recent mental health assessment that's in effect at the time you do the update. And the purpose of having these mental health assessment updates required as part of the rule is to make sure that you are routinely looking back, identifying any changes that may have occurred in the individual's life, as well as documenting the current needs and the current status of the individual. If you're working with somebody regularly, you know, sometimes you don't necessarily see the changes. If you're seeing them week to week to week, sometimes those changes are easy to miss. It's similar to, you know, raising a child, and day to day to day, they don't look that much different, but from their school picture one fall to the next, you start to see changes. It's the same kind of thing with the mental health assessment, and if you have that annual mental health assessment, there should be some changes going along. If the person is receiving care on an ongoing basis, we would expect that they're moving along in recovery and that there would be some changes to assess and document. So how do you make the case for medical necessity? One of the main ways that you do this in your clinical record is through the ITP review, that treatment plan review, which the rule, again, requires a minimum of every 6 months. The rule requires that you do a thorough review of the individual's treatment. This means that you must look at every goal on the person's treatment plan, and you must consider and document that you have considered progress towards each of those goals. If you have well-written objectives as part of your treatment plan, that makes this process of treatment plan review much easier. If your objectives are written in a way that allows that is measurable, then it is easy for you to measure progress, which is part of what is required of a treatment plan review document. In addition, as you review the treatment plan, you need to consider each of the services that's currently being provided and whether or not those are effective in helping move the person towards their goals. Once you've done that, you should be able to identify changes that are needed in the interventions. If the person has made good progress, then the changes in interventions may be a reduction in frequency. If the person has not made good progress, then maybe the interventions need to be done more frequently, or maybe there's an intervention that needs to be added. No change over and over and over on a treatment plan review is a red flag to a reviewer, because if the person is making progress, we would expect there to be changes in a treatment plan. And if the person is not making progress, we would expect there to be changes in the treatment plan. So either way, when you say no change on your treatment plan, that's an indication that the service that you've put on the treatment plan may not be medically necessary. So that concludes my piece of the presentation. Before we move into Chris's presentation, where she's going to go through some of the more concrete examples, some case studies, and then show you some both good and bad examples of documentation, we wanted to pause and give you a chance to ask any questions you have so far. So, Carrie, if you could instruct people as to how they can ask a question, we'll pause now for those questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one on your phone and record your name. Thank you. Once again, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one. Thank you. One question in queue. Let me check the name. One moment, please. We have a question from Kim. Your line is now open.
Yes. Hi. I'm calling regarding some of the guidelines with ITPs. My understanding is that we need to follow not only the state but federal guidelines. And I'm curious because I thought the federal guidelines require ITPs to be done every 3 months, and the state says 6 months. So I'm seeking clarification on that.
Can you tell me what federal guidelines you're referring to exactly?
Well, and I don't really know, to be honest. That's just been historically what I've been told, and so I'm not even sure if that's accurate.
Okay. You know, there are times when there are specific programs or specific evidence-based practices that require or recommend that you make updates more often. What I'm talking about with the every 6 months is this is the minimum requirement to be compliant with Rule 132.
Okay.
So if you are billing a Rule 132 service, then what we will be looking for, what the collaborative will be looking for us, DMH, is whether or not you have updated, you've reviewed the progress and updated your treatment plans a minimum of every 6 months.
Okay.
If you want to do it more often than that, that is not a problem, and that's a best practice to, you know, update your treatment plans as frequently as there are changes. And it's great if there are changes more frequently and, you know, you want to make updates more often than that because it means the person's making progress towards their recovery.
And I completely agree with that line of thinking. There's times where I might update it in 2 months or 6 months.
Yep.
But I guess what intrigued me was your statement about the state making sure that they also follow federal guidelines. And so I was hoping you might be able to speak to any federal guideline that you're aware of that requires an ITP to be done every 3 months.
There's not a federal guideline related to Rule 132 that requires a treatment plan more often than that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Our next question is from Mr. Shetty. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Shetty calling. My quick question was, is there a monitoring tool out for FY17?
It is out, I believe. Chris can correct me if I'm wrong. It should be posted to the collaborative's website, and I don't believe there were changes to it, but I should just stop talking and let Chris or somebody from the collaborative verify that.
Okay.
Yes, they are posted to the collaborative website, and that's towards the end of my presentation. I will go over with how to access those.
Perfect. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Carrie. Then I'm going to turn things over to Chris McConkie to go on with the next part of the presentation.
Thank you, Leanne, and welcome, everyone. During the remainder of today's training, I will be going through several examples of clinical records and discussing with you why some of the examples are acceptable and why some are not. These are not actual clinical records. I just want to make that really clear. I will also discuss types of Rule 132 non-compliant documentation that the collaborative continues to see, provide you with some tips from the reviewers, along with directing you to some helpful resources. We will begin with a case study that was developed for this training. I just want to note that the elements that need to be included on a mental health assessment will not be covered during this training today. The case study used in this training only includes enough information to allow participants to learn and discuss about treatment planning and treatment plan review. I will give you a moment to read each slide before moving on. Betty's mental health assessment relates that she is a middle-aged Caucasian female who speaks English verbally. She was referred by her primary care physician for treatment of depression and anxiety, and she was recently diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. She is her own guardian, has no prior or current legal issues, and it is determined that she is not a risk to herself or others. Continuing with her mental health assessment, we see that Betty is a high school graduate and has an associate's degree in liberal arts. She has a car and a driver's license and works part-time. She has reported that she has a loss of interest in her normal activities and was recently widowed. She has minimal family support. Although she has two adult children, she is estranged from one and the other lives out of state. There is no history of substance abuse or mental illness in her family, and she has not prescribed psychotropic medications. She has never received mental health services. However, she is receptive to receiving them now as she has had some problems at work. It was noted by the clinician that Betty has been having depressed mood most of the day, every day, has experienced a loss of interest, insomnia, diminished ability to think and concentrate, and not listed on this slide, but was listed on her MHA, was that she has also gained weight. This led the clinician to diagnose Betty with major depressive disorder. The clinician then recommended the following specific services for Betty: community support individual, therapy counseling individual, and case management mental health. So once Betty's mental health assessment was signed off by the LPHA, Betty and her therapist developed the treatment plan that you can see on this slide. Treatment plans are the guide for service delivery. It is developed with the individual and is based on the mental health assessment and any additional evaluations. If goals and objectives on the ITP are written as I statements, as Betty's are, individuals are likely to be more invested in the treatment plan and feel empowered. For this example, Betty's treatment plan for Goal 1 notes that she wants to get a handle on her depression and anxiety so that she can keep her job, and 4 objectives, which are small steps towards achieving the goal. When objectives are written in smaller steps, the person will feel more likely that the objectives are achievable and, as a result, be more invested in the treatment process. Use of canned goals, objectives, and jargon are not good clinical practice, as canned goals and objectives are not documentation of individualized treatment, and jargon is not user-friendly language and often not understandable to the person receiving services. As you can see on this treatment plan, Betty is going to receive three services, as we've already mentioned: therapy counseling individual, community support individual, and case management mental health. The ITP includes information on amount, frequency, and duration. And just to review, amount relates to how much time will the service be provided, minutes or hours. Frequency relates to how often the service will be provided, weekly, monthly, for example. And duration relates to how long it is expected that the service will be provided, 3 months, 6 months, for example. The ITP identifies who the responsible person is for the delivery of the services and the expected outcome date, which is a future date when the person is expected to achieve the objective. So on this ITP, Betty will receive therapy counseling individual one time a week for 1 hour for 6 months. If Betty's needs change during the six-month period, however, it would be expected that the ITP would be reviewed and modified as needed at any time during the six-month period. And just one more note is that use of phrases such as as needed, PRN, at least, and up to do not meet requirements for amount or frequency. Now let's look at a review of this ITP. First, I would like to remind everyone that the ITP review is required to include continuity of care planning with the individual or the individual's parent or guardian, an estimated transition or discharge date, and identify goals for continuing care. We did not include these items in this training document as we are focusing on other elements of the treatment planning process. Betty's ITP review that we will be discussing will be seen over three separate slides. On this slide, a review of progress is clearly seen. Betty has made moderate progress as she has only identified some underlying reasons for her depression and anxiety. And as a result of the moderate progress, it's noted that therapy and counseling will continue. Rule 132 requires that ITPs be reviewed by the ELPHA and QMHP no less than once every 6 months from the date of the ELPHA original signature on the most recent ITP. The purpose of this review is to determine if the goals noted on the ITP are being met and whether each of the services described in the plan has contributed to meeting the stated goals. In addition, Rule 132 also specifies what information progress notes must contain when providing specific services. It is a requirement for several Rule 132 services that the progress note include a description of the progress made toward the goals and objectives on the ITP as a result of the service being provided. These specific documentation requirements for delivery of mental health services are found within Rule 132 under each service. So on this slide, we see a review of the second, third, and fourth objectives for Betty's goal, which is I want to get a handle on my depression and anxiety so that I can keep my job. As with objective one, a review of progress is clearly seen in the review sections for each of these objectives. Betty has learned three coping skills to deal with her anxiety and depression and continues to have difficulty with relaxing enough to fall asleep most nights. The review notes that she needs more practice in applying coping skills and that she needs to continue to learn relaxation techniques. As a result, this ITP review reflects that community support group is going to be added to assist her in meeting this objective. Additionally, This review notes that Betty no longer needs to develop community resources, and so the service of case management mental health is going to be discontinued. The information on these two slides may have been a progress note in Betty's record, or it may have been noted on the ITP that is being reviewed. Either option is acceptable. Use of checkboxes on ITP reviews for indicating progress with terms such as met, not met, change, inactive, continue, and nothing else when documenting progress often leads to noncompliance, as this type of documentation does not give a clear review of the progress made during the review period. This is the third slide of the treatment plan review for Betty. It is based upon the review of progress and evaluation of needed services. All modifications to ITPs must be indicated on the ITP review and include the dated original signature with credentials of the QMHP and the LPHA, in addition to the person receiving services and guardian. This slide doesn't include a signature section in order to have room to focus on today's training material, but they are required by Rule 132. When a need for a service arises and that service is not on the ITP, the need may be documented in a progress note signed and dated by the staff person who determined the need. However, before the service can be provided, the ITP must be updated with the additional service to be provided and signed by the QMHP and the LPHA. So as we get ready to move into the progress note examples, we do want to make sure that it's noted that all of the progress notes include at the top of the note whether the note is acceptable, whether it would be found substantiated for the progress note, or if it's unacceptable. And it's noted in red bold lettering at the top of each note. So please refer to this notation as we discuss the progress notes. As you can see, it's noted at the top that this note is acceptable. There is a clear description that Betty attended therapy counseling individual and the goal and objective that was the focus. There is also a clear description of the clinical intervention. Staff assisted her with identifying factors that contribute to her depression and processed feelings of depression and anxiety. As we continue with this progress note, Betty's response to the intervention is clearly documented. Betty was actively involved in the session and appeared open in relating her feelings and history of depressed feelings. The note also clearly states that Betty continues to make slow progress towards this objective as she was able to identify a few factors that contribute to her depression. This progress note is also acceptable. There is a clear description that Betty attended community support individual and what the goal and objective was the focus. There's also a clear description of the clinical intervention. The session's focus was on identifying coping skills, and the therapist provided examples of coping skills and worked with Betty on which ones would work for her. The response to the intervention is clearly documented in the note. Betty was initially unable to think of ways to make herself get out of bed in the morning, stating that life is just too hard. But she was able to identify one coping skill with prompting. The note also clearly states that Betty made minimal progress towards this objective as she is having a hard time accepting life without her partner. This note is not an acceptable note. There is no clinical intervention. The only information on the note is reported by Betty. What did the therapist do? The collaborative frequently sees progress notes during post-payment review that only reflect what the person receiving services did or said, and there's no mention of the clinical intervention that was provided. When this is noted, the claim would be found unsubstantiated for post-payment review tool item number 2. It is important to document the person's comments and responses, but you still need to include information about clinical intervention. Likewise, being talkative is not a response to the intervention, but we did note that there really wasn't an intervention. And noting only that Betty made some progress is not a clear evaluation of progress. So that note would have had a problem during post-payment review. This note is acceptable for the following reasons. There is a clear intervention of what the case manager did for Betty and what that person did as a billable service. Case management mental health activities can include identifying and investigating available resources, which this note reflects. Case management mental health may be done with or without the person present. And please note that case management mental health is an activity, while community support is a therapeutic intervention. Progress notes for case management mental health are only required to describe a description of the activity. As you can see, this progress note only contains a description of the activity. And the Rule 132 requirements for what the note has to include can be found in Rule 132 under each service. To provide an example of the difference between case management mental health and community support individual, I will add that this service could have been community support individual if what had actually occurred and what had been documented was that Betty was present prior to the call. The staff person had discussed with Betty how to make the call, educating her, teaching her skills, prepared her for questions that may be asked of her. The staff person assisted Betty during the call, and following the call, staff and Betty discussed how the call went, and staff assisted her with identifying next steps that Betty would need to do. So, as Leanne said, community support individual is about teaching, practicing, role play. Case management mental health is doing for. Before we move on, I would like to point out that we are moving away from Betty in our training example. So as you can see, that this is a note for someone named Johnny. And this note is unacceptable for the following reasons. Reviewing paperwork, calling in medications, and leaving a voicemail are not billable Rule 132 services. The note does not reflect that consultation with the pharmacist occurred, and it doesn't reflect that any assistance was provided. This progress note for Pete is unacceptable for the following reasons. The intervention, if you look at the intervention, it is just a copy and paste from the rule, the service definition for community support residential. A lot of times the collaborative will see this in progress notes, and it's thought that the belief is that if you, that's what the description is, the service is what you're doing, and so the description of the intervention is, relates to the definition of the service. What actually is required to be noted is what actually the intervention was. And in this note, if you read through all the definition stuff, what finally is mentioned that occurred is that the person discussed with the group the household rules and chores. That is not a billable service. However, the biggest reason this note would be found unsubstantiated is that Pete was asleep during the meeting. So you cannot bill if the person did not actually receive the service, and they wouldn't receive the service if they were asleep or if they left group for a period of time, and the collaborative does see notes like that at times. Also, I would like to note the chores associated with being part of a group of people living together, such as in a residential housing, are not necessary a Rule 132 billable service. If the person's MHA and ITP do not identify the need to learn the task as a medically necessary service, the service would not be billable. For instance, a person may be fully capable of knowing how to take the trash out, and this may be a chore for the person as part of living in the residence. In this instance, taking the trash out would not be billable. Also, observing the person taking the trash out, directing the person to take the trash out, are likewise not billable interventions. The collaborative continues to often see this type of documentation, especially with community support residential notes. This is another progress note for Pete, and it is considered unacceptable. As we just mentioned, observing is not a billable 132 service. Pete did all the work. There was no clinical intervention that was documented, only that the writer watched him do it. Furthermore, Pete's response is not related to an intervention, but we did just mention there wasn't one. Not related to post-payment review, but it is important to note that the objective that was being addressed is that he wants to prepare healthy meals. And baking blueberry muffins for breakfast, I don't think counts as that. Also, progress is vague and unclear. The intervention on the previous slide does not note that prompts had been given to Pete, but as we see towards the end of this progress note, the staff person noted that he was able to complete the task with minimal prompts. But on the other hand, this is also a very similar note to what we just discussed. The note that we did just discuss was not acceptable, but this one is. They were both about cooking. Remember that the previous progress note was not acceptable as staff were only observing, there was no clinical intervention documented, and the response to the intervention and progress towards goals and objectives in the treatment plan did not comply with Rule 132. But as you can see in this progress note, the clinical intervention is clearly stated, the therapist educated Pete on healthy choices and assisted him with comparing nutritional values. Also, Pete's response to the intervention relates back to the education he received and progress towards learning about healthy meals is noted. And just a note to clarify, this service to Pete is related to a physical illness. However, his mental health assessment and treatment plan, which are not part of this training, did specify how his diabetes is impacting his mental health and that he is wanting to move from his supervised apartment and live independently in the community, which is resulting in his need to improve his nutritional skills. This slide reflects mental health assessment Rule 132 requirements that collaborative reviewers continue to see as non-compliant when conducting post-payment review. So these are requirements that the collaborative continues to frequently not see in place. The OPHA is required to sign the initial mental health assessment within 30 days of the first face-to-face contact when treatment is initiated, and that date is a date designated by the provider. The initial mental health assessment is required to be signed by the OPHA before the OPHA signs the treatment plan. The mental health assessment identifies the individual's mental health service needs and recommends service delivery. The treatment plan includes the goals and objectives to meet the needs identified on the MHA in which Rule 132 services shall be provided. It's extremely important. I cannot stress enough that everyone pays close attention to dates. MHAs are required to be updated annually and signed by the OPHA within a year of the OPHA signature on the prior MHA. And credentials, of course, must accompany signatures. So this slide, the last slide was about MHAs, and so this slide is about treatment plan requirements that the collaborative reviewers continue to see as non-compliant. The initial ITP must be signed by the OPHA within 45 days of the OPHA signature on the initial MHA. The ITP goals must be reviewed at least every 6 months by the QMHP and signed by the LPHA, whether or not the client is present. And as Leanne mentioned, that is the minimum. Rule 132 defines credentials as LPHA, QMHP, MHP, RSA, or professional designation in the part. An original signature is a signature affixed to any document that is made by the person to whom the signature belongs, either in ink or via electronic means. If you're using electronic signatures, you must comply with Rule 132.85F, which puts the requirements for electronic signature. This slide shows some acceptable and unacceptable examples for documenting specific services. So a specific service for medication training would be psychotropic medication training. During post-payment, if it was, if all that was listed was psychiatric services, the claim would be, could be disallowed. There's three different types, and psychiatric services doesn't really tell you much of, you know, what it is. Is it medication training? Is it administration? You know, what is the psychiatric service that's being provided? That's one reason why it's important to always put the specific service. Just like in community support individual, there are several different types of community support services. So only stating community support services doesn't really tell you which exact service is being provided or put on the treatment plan. As we've done with mental health assessments and treatment plans, this slide is about progress notes and its areas that Rule 132 requirements that the collaborative reviewers continue to see as non-compliant, and so we just want to touch on these two. Progress notes must be signed by the person providing the service and include their credentials. Collaborative reviewers have found that at times, the staff supervisor is signing the progress note, not the person that actually provided the service. Rule 132 requires that the progress notes are signed by the person providing the service. Also, the progress note must be documented as a billable Rule 132 intervention. For instance, progress notes that reflect only what the consumer said or did during the session do not reflect that a clinical intervention took place. We saw this earlier with one of Betty's progress notes. In addition, merely copying and pasting the service definition from Rule 132 into the progress note does not accurately reflect the intervention that occurred. Both of these examples would result in a claim being found unsubstantiated. And then we have just some tips from the reviewers. Consistent organization of records helps provider staff know where the records are located. They are able to easily reference the MHA, ITP, and progress notes as they provide the services. In addition, collaborative reviewers can locate all required documents during a post-payment review. Missing documents or those difficult to locate could result in a lower substantiated score. All provider staff should know and understand the Rule 132 requirements for documentation along with the provider's record-keeping system. Leanne went over this as part of the provider's responsibility. It is important that when documents are written rather than typed, the documents need to be legible. If staff cannot read their own documentation, reviewers are also most likely not able to read the documentation, and the claim would have the potential of being disallowed as it would be unclear what the content is. Regular review of staff documentation is critical in order to ensure that staff are understanding the expectations of the provider and of Rule 132. And as we've talked about canned documentation is that kind of documentation. It's the same across consumers. or across documents of a consumer. It is basically copying and pasting. This type of documentation is not good clinical practice. Progress notes need enough detail to show evidence of medically necessary individualized treatment. And treatment plan should be written so that the person can understand the content of his or her treatment plan. Avoid jargon. So as I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk about some resources that are available to you. Today's presentation is going to be available on the Collaborative's website within 1 week of today's training. In order to locate this training, you go to the Collaborative website. There's a tab to click on this, for providers, and you click on that, and then you'll see to the left of the screen, you'll see several links, and you would need to click on the link titled Provider Information. And when you do that, it's like you are opening a treasure box. It'll pull up a treasure trove of information that is very helpful. There are lots and lots and lots of information and links on that, you know, once you've clicked on Provider Information. The first header you're going to see is titled Provider Trainings. The items listed under the header are slides from past trainings. And today's PowerPoint slides will be posted here within a week. If you scroll down a little further, you're going to see a header called Resources. The items listed under that header are the MP3 recordings from past trainings. And today's MP3 recording will be posted under that header within a week. And then if you scroll down even further, you're going to find the FY17 provider monitoring tools, along with a couple of previous year's tools. The FY17 post-payment review and CPG tools and guidelines, the provider survey, which is left at the conclusion of the reviews, it can be found there. The provider monitoring protocols can be found there, and a template for the plan of improvement are all located on the Collaborative website under the Provider Information link, and then under the header of FY17 Provider Monitoring Tools. And I would encourage everyone to spend some time getting familiar with the Collaborative website and the information that it contains. It's very helpful. And then some other important resources that are available to you include your DHS CMH regional staff, and the Collaborative website is on this screen also, which I've just discussed that. The DHS DMH website, which can be found at the address on this slide. And then DMH has a mailbox set up for Rule 132 interpretation clarification questions that you may have over the course of a year. You can send those questions to the mailbox address on this slide. A person submitting the questions will receive a response within 1 to 2 weeks. All the questions and answers are posted quarterly by DMH to the DMH website. And answers to questions that other providers have sent are, like I said, are posted quarterly. So you can go to the DMH website. You can search for the provider manual, and then as with the Collaborative website, the DMH website also contains a lot of extremely important, useful information, and I encourage all of you to be familiar with that. When you're in the provider manual on the website, there's a header titled header 4, and it's titled Mental Health Services. The Service Definition and Reimbursement Guide and the most recent Rule 132 version are also found under that header. And that's where you can also find the Rule 132 question and answers that providers have asked. So, Carrie, I believe we're ready to open the line for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we would like to begin the question and answer session of the conference. To ask a question, please press star followed by the number 1. Unmute your phone and record your name with a prompt. You must record your name clearly for your question to be introduced. To cancel your question, you may press star followed by the number 2. One moment, please, to see if we have questions. We have our first question in queue, which is from Ted McLean. Your line is now open.
Yes, just want a clarification regarding case management services. In one of your earlier slides, you showed that case management is something that's provided, is an activity that's provided for resources outside the agency. And my question was, can case management be used to engage a client, say, to come in for services within that agency too? Like for additional resources or for an assessment?
It is used for referring a person outside of the agency. So do you want to explain a little bit more of what your question is like? Can you give me an example?
Someone was trying to engage a client to come in. They may have came in for a session and had not been able to be reached after that maybe first contact. But now they're trying to reach out to them to come in some more for services or to take additional tests.
No, that would not be billed as case management mental health.
Well, how would what type of service would you classify that as then?
Some services are not billable services.
That's okay. I just wanted to be clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question in queue is from John Deku. Your line is now open.
Hello. First question I wanted to ask is about the treatment plan. And under the providing services, what kind of person would be listed under there? Is it the person writing the treatment plan? Is it everyone who's going to be part of the services if other people are involved?
For the responsible staff person, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
It would be the person that is responsible for the treatment plan.
Okay.
So it wouldn't necessarily be the person that's actually providing the service. So who's taking responsibility that treatment plan, you know, for the completion of it and everything?
Okay, thank you. And one other really quick question is, do we need to list things like the MHA update and treatment plan update as part of the treatment plan interventions?
No, those are not required to be on the treatment plans.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question in queue is from Balaji. Your line is now open.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
My question is on treatment plan. Number one, to collaboratively work together with the primary therapist that designed the treatment plan, is it appropriate for psychosocial rehab to develop collaborative treatment plan, or can we have our own assessment, or we have to use the primary assessment? I need clarification. And also, as a secondary therapist worker, do we need to do 6-month review, or is it totally responsibility of the primary therapist? Those are the clarity that I would like to understand.
Thank you. First off, I'd just like to note that the ITPs need to be integrated ITPs. And so, you know, a primary therapist versus a secondary therapist, there would need to be one mental health assessment and one treatment plan for Rule 132 purposes, but agencies have their own different ways of doing things. But if the reviewers came in to do a post-payment review, they would be looking at the mental health assessment and the treatment plan. So they would need to be integrated. So if you presented the reviewer with an MHA for PSR, that would be, you know, confusing. So they are required to be integrated. Does that answer your question?
Somehow. So I understand the collaboration aspect of it, but to assess someone for, to assess a consumer for psychosocial rehab groups, can you advise me, is that has to be done by the primary? Because we assess what group will address specific medical necessity through intervention of therapy sessions, group therapy sessions. So I have to determine which group I need to put that particular consumer in, and I think I want to know if it's appropriate to assess in PSR, or we still have to depend on the primary assessment.
That is part of what the LPHA, the responsibility of the LPHA that signs off on the integrated treatment plan and mental health assessment. The LPHA's job is to decide what is medically necessary. And so, you know, they would say then, so maybe the person, if you're talking about PSR, maybe the person, you know, is trying to move out and live independently and they have zero cooking skills, and they would need cooking skills in order to live independently in the community. That information should be available to the LPHA. And then that would be incorporated in the treatment plan that is signed by the LPHA. So everything needs to be integrated. And I guess I'm not understanding the primary, secondary therapist role. And I think that's specific to your agency, maybe. So if you would like to send in a question about this further, you can send it to that DHS DMH mailbox address.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question on queue is from Amy Powers. Your line is now open.
Hi, I had a question on treatment planning. We conduct a lot of services to assist individuals in keeping their environments clean and healthy. And so on the service plan, we typically, so the individual has a goal to keep their apartment clean or keep in their residential setting, like it's very important for them to keep their housing. And then we prescribe services depending on the setting, community support individual, community support residential. But those, sometimes when stating the objective, they tend to be very housekeeping oriented. And I'm wondering if to be in compliance, they need to be tied in more to their mental health symptoms, like if they have symptoms of the negative symptoms of mental illness where they really don't care about anything and they don't care if they have bed bugs or anything, and they really need prompting, support, encouragement, task analysis to get those things done. Does that need to be on the service plan, or can it be a little simpler?
There would be need to be an overall goal, and then objectives is what I would believe that you're talking about, the separate little objectives, the smaller steps to reach those goals. And it could be that you have the objectives completed, you know, earlier than 6 months, and then you can just take those off the treatment plan through a treatment plan modification. But
I guess I'm really asking about the wording.
We see that quite a bit on post-payment reviews. We've seen things about apartment checks, just coming in and doing an apartment check, making sure that they're nice and tidy and, you know, that they're obeying what the rules of the apartment are, that's not a billable service. but it could be community support if the person, if the staff person is going into the apartment, showing them how you dust, you know, showing you how you, you know, effective ways to wash dishes, things like that. We've also seen it with hygiene in residences where the staff person woke the person up and made them brush their teeth and made them, you know, made them do this or those. That's not billable. And so you want to try to steer away from those kind of things. And they need to be medically necessary services. So it needs to be tied to the treatment plan because that's what guides services.
So in the treatment plan objectives, are you seeking that to be in compliance, that medically necessary language? Do we need to say as an objective, not only, you know, will individual be instructed or prompted to dust, but do we need to say something about how their mental illness gets in the way of them completing those tasks?
Well, you could, that could be in the mental health assessment.
Okay.
That the person, you know, there could be a description in the assessment that the person's having a hard time, you know, that they don't care, you know, that you're observing this or that they're talking about this. And then the treatment plan is going to be based on the mental health assessment. And so that's when you're going to have the clear goal that relates back to the mental health assessment and then the objectives. I do want to caution you because I think I heard you say that directed or prompted or things like that, that those are not billable services. It has to be a clear intervention, medically necessary intervention. And we do see that quite a bit where staff observed, as I talked about in the training, they observed the person do something or they told the person to do something. It needs to be an actual clinical intervention.
Okay. So if you are, I'm the staff person and I'm showing someone, like I'm dusting half the table and they're dusting the other half or like, is that not billable, or is that demonstrating, coaching, or if
so,
the issue is anxiety, you know, then we can focus on the mental health issue in order to get the job done. If they're just so overwhelmed by it, they can't get a list together and actually do it.
And that's what you would reflect in the progress note.
Okay.
You know, maybe you're dusting because the person has a huge phobia to germs and dust, and so you're working with the person, you know, from one direction, or maybe you're working with the person to teach them to learn how to dust because they want to move out into their own apartment and they have no clear understanding of independent living skills. And so you could work with the person from that direction doing the exact same thing, and it would be documented in the progress note what you were working on, why you were doing it, how the person responded, and then the progress that service, teaching them how to dust that day, how does that tie back to the treatment plan goals and objectives?
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question on queue is from Adam Chiodi. Your line is now open. Please check the mute button. Adam? Let's take our next question on queue, which is from Linda Bergman. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Question regarding the MHA and ITP. You mentioned that the MHA needs to be signed before the ITP. Is there ever a time when they can be signed on the same day? Is that a problem?
Yes, it can be signed on the same day. It just needs to be completed first.
Sure.
Because that's what gives you the information for the treatment plan.
Of course, right. Okay, great.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you. Our next question on queue is from John Baku. Your line is now open.
Yes, we were just wondering, if we review a treatment plan without the client present, can we still bill for that service? Hello?
Yeah, that is fine. You have to document, though, why the person was not there. Sometimes you're under time restraints to complete things, and the person has not come in for services for whatever reason, and you still have to have a compliant treatment plan. And so you would need to make sure you note why it was done that way, because it's extremely important. That the person be actively involved in their own treatment plan development, modification, and review. The person served needs to have a very clear understanding of what they're coming in for and what their goals and things of what they're wanting to achieve.
Okay. And then also, when we begin a session, if the session is supposed to start at 6 o'clock and we begin at 6:02, do we round that time, or do we enter the note as a session beginning at 6:02?
Progress time for services is done in units, and so one unit would be seven minutes to 15 minutes, and so a note that is less than that, you would not be able to bill for.
Correct, but if I start a session off of the hour mark, does the note need to reflect the exact time that I started the session, or can I put that the session started at 6 o'clock if it's only 2 minutes past?
What we pay attention to is the unit, so
okay.
I would think that you need to be, you know, if you can be precise, that would be the best thing to do, but when we're doing post-payment, we look to see that there is a, you know, one unit is 15 minutes, and so there needs to be a service note for if the claim was for 15 minutes, there would need to be a note for that.
I think that we answered this, but the reason why we're asking it is we do concurrent documentation, and so we've been told that if we enter a session room at 6:02 or 6:04, that we need to make sure that we are to the minute. And what I'm hearing you say is that as long as our session falls within, you know, the an hour time frame, that you're doing it by the unit, and we can, as long as we are rounded up to that unit and we're being accurate in our documentation, that is fine.
Rule 132 doesn't specify that it has to be to the minute. I would encourage you to look at what Rule 132 says about documenting time and duration. There has to be a start time and a duration.
Okay.
And that's all that's all Rule 132 says about documenting time. That could be a policy for your own agency.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question on queue is from Demetrius Tobbs. Your line is now open.
Yes, I want to go back to the question that the gentleman was speaking about with the PSR services, and I want to clarify something. So let's say, for instance, in the treatment plan, there was something concerning medication compliance, and the way PSR works in some programs, I mean some agencies as well as ours, is that PSR is looked at as a service, and they see it as a standalone service. So whenever we refer a consumer to PSR to get certain services provided for them, we will refer them to PSR. So I'm wondering, and I'm thinking that he may have been asking this, but I want to ask it as well, is that when a consumer is being referred to PSR, we should just do that as a modification to the treatment plan then, right, opposed to trying to do a whole other one separate for a PSR. It should just be a modification, which is an add-on to the original treatment plan. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah. We have the regional liaison supervisor, Tammy Mayer, on the line, and I'm going to let her talk to this. She supervises the liaisons that come and do post-payment review.
Okay.
Tammy?
Okay, I'm on here. I'm not real sure what the question is. What was it?
Well, I can't reiterate his question, but I was just trying to give a better scenario maybe for understanding of, okay, if we know that the consumer is going to be in PSR and we've actually identified that this consumer would be better suited to be given more instructions or even better suited to receive services to help him within, let's say that we want to have medication compliance. And we know our PSR service has a group for that, you know, that runs, you know, from a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And we refer them to our PSR service. All we need to do is just put a modification onto the ITP. To
correct.
Say, okay, we've identified that the consumer needs, you know, medication maintenance, and we want to put them to the PSR service so that they can now receive even further instructions on how to maintain their medications and how to do whatever they're going to do for their medications. So, in other words, opposed to doing a separate ITP, all the PSR has to do or whoever's managing the PSR needs to do is just put in a modification of the treatment plan to add that PSR service and then document the time frame that's going to take them to complete that particular service.
Well, if
is
you're
that
one,
right?
When you do your assessment, you decide what services that they need that's going to fit their needs. And then, of course, you carry that to the treatment plan. If within that time frame or after that you find that they do need this PSR group, then you would want to reflect it on your MHA and your ICP saying, you know, you've done a new assessment about this. Because assessments, MHAs can be done at any time because you can assess if something changes in their life. You know, assessments are ongoing. So you would want to add it to that, but you would also need to add PSR group to your treatment plan in order for it to be okay to bill it, because you have to have a specific service on the treatment plan in order to bill 132 services.
Okay, so then whenever that, yeah, so you're saying whenever that particular service is needed, you have to document it not only in the ITP, but you also have to make sure that you can show that you did a new assessment, a new MHA, or you added to the MHA or something like that, and then
you
put
can,
it on the
you
ITP.
You can make it like an addendum. You don't have to do a whole new MHA if it's not up, you know, because those only have to be updated annually. You know, every year
okay.
You see the MHA. But if you know, if there's a portion of the MHA that for some reason they're decompensating in an area or something, you could reassess that portion and make like an addendum to your MHA and then, of course, add that, you know, another objective or goal to your treatment plan with the PSR group.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yes. And then the other question I wanted to get a better understanding about the time. So just to be clear, Rule 132 only says that, hey, we want to know what time something happened and then what the duration was. And that's all that they're worried about. They're not really worried about the
that
end
is
time
correct.
Or something
the
like
rule,
that.
Yeah, the rule
okay.
requires a start time and duration.
Okay, so we don't have to worry about rolling, like, you know, rounding up to the nearest 15 or nearest union and stuff like that. That's not an issue with Rule 132.
You put down the time that you're with the, you know, the person that, you know, you start, they came in at 6 and they left at 6:55, or they came in at 10 after 6, like they were late for their session, so they came in at 10 after 6, and you put the, you know, put 6:10 and then your total time, or 6:10 to 7, you know, you can document however you want. As long as it's the start time and the duration.
Right. But we know that units are what's going to really determine the actual compensation, though. Am I right about that, the units?
We do look for units. That's how when it comes up on our claim run, we know how many units were billed for a certain person on a certain day. So, like, if it's a PSR group or community support group, in the system, it rolls them up if it's the same credential. So when we're looking at a PSR group note, it may have 16 units. So a lot of times that would be 4 one-hour groups. It could be, you know, 2-hour groups. But however it works out, we have to find that 16 units, whatever is showing up on the claim run.
Okay, so you do want to just find out to make sure you got those number of units, and that's all you worry about. Okay, got it. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. I'm done.
Sure.
Thank you. There are no further questions sent to you at this time. Again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number 1. One moment, please. Our next question on queue is from Krista Taylor. The line is now open.
Hi, I have a clarification question, and then I have a specific question. My specific question went to, on your example of your treatment plan for Betty, under 132, I thought objectives had to be measurable, and we struggle with this with therapy interventions all the time. I believe the objective for Betty was something like, I want to understand why I feel so depressed all the time. Would that be an acceptable objective, or would it have to be something that's more measurable?
Give us one moment. We're looking for the slide.
Yes. This is Chris. It would be much better if it was measurable. It does need to be measurable, and as Leanne mentioned earlier in her part, the more measurable an objective is, the much easier it's going to be for you to complete your treatment plan review, because you're going to have a precise thing. If you look at objective 2 in that treatment plan, objective 1, I think, is what Krista is talking about, and it says, I want to understand why I feel so depressed and anxious all the time. Well, that's not very measurable. Objective 2 is, I will learn 3 coping skills, and then it gives some more information. Well, that is measurable because you're going to be able to know, did that person, was Betty able to learn 3 coping skills? And so this is a good example of what Leanne was talking about, how doing a treatment plan review on those 2 objectives, you're going to have a much easier time doing a review of treatment of objective 2, because it's very measurable, and it's going to be much more difficult to do one for number 1. So that was a good – thank you for pointing that out, Krista. But these were samples that we had to create, and it's more difficult than you think. It's much easier to use real records.
Well,
that was a good catch. Thank you.
When the goals and stuff are being the measurable stuff, that's going to be a certification. For post-payment, we don't necessarily look at every make sure that the objective is measurable and all that. That's more of your certification.
Okay.
Thank
so
you,
my
Tammy.
Second question, just to clarify, someone asked the question if you can bill for treatment plan review when the client is not present, and I'm not sure if I heard the answer correctly. It sounded like yes, but you have to document very specifically why the client was not present.
It is, and then when the client signs it, you need to have in their client signed late due to whatever. Because it'll look funny on your treatment, and if you're looking at your Q and your L and if maybe a staffing, if everybody signed it one date and 2 months later the client signed it, you know, that would look kind of strange that your client didn't sign it if there's no documentation in there explaining that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tina Cortez. Your line is now open.
Hi. I have a follow-up question about the billing for the ITP review. The service definition reimbursement guide explicitly states on the treatment planning page that time spent writing and typing the document is not billable. So if you're just sitting in your office at your computer reviewing goals without the client present, that would be typing and writing the document. So is that still billable?
Well, when you're reviewing the treatment plan, you would be reviewing it with somebody. Maybe it's with another staff person who is providing services as well, and you guys can be discussing, you know, how this goal is working. Do you think that because maybe the client isn't present, and you could be talking to another person who is providing either a case management service or maybe the PSR group, and you could say, you know, how do you feel this person is doing during these sessions? Do you think that, you know, this goal is working or this objective is working? So you could review it that way with somebody else who's providing the service. But then you also want to, as soon as the consumer's back in services, to discuss it with them as well. Because you're
okay,
right,
sure.
You can't just type it because that's just paperwork. If you're typing
right, so
it with them sitting there with you, that's different.
Right. So if I'm the only provider, then I'm not going to be able to bill for reviewing the treatment plan. But if I'm reviewing the treatment plan with the case manager, or like you said, or the PSR group leader or something, then that is billable.
Right.
Okay. We hadn't done it that way before. That's great. And then my second question, I noticed in all of your slides regarding progress notes, it kept explicitly noting, like the last section talked about progress towards goals, which we have not historically explicitly stated in our progress notes. Should we be doing that?
It's in the rule as part of the note. Part of the note, you have to have the interaction between the staff and the consumer. You have
right.
to have the client's response to the intervention, not just a response, but it's actually the response to that intervention that they got that day. And then what kind of progress are making this day with this service? What kind of progress? Because people get that progress confused with reviewing the ITP progress, because those are two distinct different progress.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Balaji. Your line is now open.
Yeah, my question is this. In PSR, we do have documentation of activities, responses, and how the consumer is gaining in the skills that we are addressing. Is it our responsibility in PSR to keep those documentation, or is it the responsibility of the primary to document those progress or activity? Could you enlighten me?
The progress on the note. Oh, go ahead, Chris.
No, you can go ahead, Tammy.
The progress on a note, whoever is providing the service is the one who would document what kind of progress was happening. Because that person, whoever is documenting the note, they're going to say what occurred today, how the person responded, if they're making progress, or say they just were not part of the group and they just didn't feel like they wanted to be there and they just made no progress today. That would all be by the person that provided the service. That's who does that note.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cindy Ali. Your line is now open.
Yeah, thank you. This question is on transportation. Can we bill, or can therapists bill pickup from home and return home? This question stems from the fact that most of the insurance arranged transportations are now disappointing the clients and is frustrating them in their recovery journey. So if a therapist, out of genuine commitment to enhance the wellness of his client, decide to pick him or her from his or her house, bring him to the office and take him back, can we bill that service as case management? Thank you.
You cannot bill transportation if that's all that occurred. Transportation is not a billable service.
If, however, you were providing a service while you were both together in a vehicle, so say, for instance, you were taking the person to the doctor's appointment and the person was really scared and anxious about the appointment and you were talking to them about some relaxation techniques or something like that, then that would be billable. But to just transport someone, you know, like a cab driver picking them up, that's not a billable service. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jimmy. Your line is now open.
Hi. My question is in regards to the mental health assessment. Is the, and I believe I'm, I just need clarification. Can the mental health assessment be billed, provided without the participant present?
No, the person needs to be present.
Or if it's a child, the parent could be there.
Yes.
Throughout the mental health assessment, so sometimes the mental health assessment takes more than one session, and there's a lot of data being collected without the patient being present, sometimes reaching out to key contacts. Is that not billable? Not sure if I'm making sense here.
Is it like you're gathering information from another provider, or
exactly consulting with another, I don't know, hospital, another entity, and so the patient, the participant is not present, but there's a lot of work being done as part of that assessment.
If you're consulting with somebody, it's possible that you're doing client-centered consultation, or you may be gathering more information about the MHA. But some of it's just paperwork, and that part just is part of doing business. I mean, you know, if the client is with you or you're consulting with somebody gathering information for the MHA, you know, those will be billable services. But if it's just typing it up and organizing it, that's just paperwork.
Okay. So, no, I was – okay, got it. I was more referring into, yeah, consulting with other – gathering information, the history behind that patient, and in order to build, finalize that mental health assessment.
Sure. Yeah, if you're gathering it from other people who have given them services, and you're talking to that person and gathering information.
Okay.
I just want to clarify that client-centered consultation, I don't want anyone to be confused about what we're talking about. Case management client-centered consultation has to be on a treatment plan before it's provided.
And it's with professionals.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Aisha. Your line is now open.
Hi. You had mentioned that the CMMH service only applies to services outside of the agency, and I'm wondering about if your agency houses many types of programs. If you're helping a client understand the benefits or like the services of a particular program, so if you were like moving someone from a mental health program to a sexual assault program or something like that, that time spent in like linking them to that service, talking about that service, would that be CMMH, or would that be billed under something else, or is it not billable?
Tammy, do you want to address this question?
Okay, thinking about it. It depends on what you're doing, but the case management mental health is really when you're linking them to other agencies. With it, when it's a separate program within your own agency, you know, that might be some treatment planning because you're talking to them about other services that might benefit them. So that could be treatment planning. It could be community support individual because you're educating them on the benefits of this program. Or so it just depends on what exactly you're doing. But case management mental health is linking them to, you know, public entitlements, Social Security, public aid, LIHEAP for electricity, even doing work with a landlord. You know, that's more case management. Mental health is outside the agency.
Okay. So it sounds like it would be safer to bill it under the community support where you're kind of helping them understand other supports within your agency that would be beneficial.
Yeah, it's whatever you guys are doing. And because, like, when we come in, we just read the note. So we can't assume anything. So whatever the note is reading is what we document, you know. So whatever you guys are, whatever you feel you're providing and how you're documenting it, because that's all we can go by is what's documented.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question is from Ted McLean. Your line is now open.
Yes, my question is regarding crisis services. Someone is currently in treatment, but they have a crisis episode where the level of care has become more intensified. The original treatment plan would have to stop at that point after they do the crisis assessment and they do a new treatment plan for the crisis services, but now they come back into their original program. That crisis plan should end, and then they go back and develop a new treatment plan altogether because services may have changed dramatically because of the crisis episode. Is that accurate?
I have seen some agencies do it that way. The rule doesn't specify that you have to, because sometimes a person may have a crisis, and then you can just review the treatment plan and update it. Like maybe they need more intense services, or so it's however your agency wants to document it, wouldn't you say, Chris?
Yes, I agree.
So there's no clear-cut rule for that. It's just that I know a modification has to happen with the treatment plan or a review has to happen with the treatment plan, but I was wondering, did they have to go back and stop the old plan? They would have to modify the plan because of the crisis situation that occurred. Because they couldn't continue with the care and not develop a new plan. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that the plan has to be modified at least twice, maybe?
Anytime you modify that, it's very important to review what has occurred on the previous treatment plan. Because the only time that you do not have to review a treatment plan is that very first one when they first come into treatment, the initial. But once they're in services, anytime you feel you have to modify it or change it, it would be in your best interest to talk about the progress or lack of progress and why you're making those modifications.
Okay.
Thank you. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question is from Renda. Your line is now open.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I would like to know in reference to billing for case management, mental health services, and like if you were helping a consumer who was not completely literate or not comfortable with using the internet and the computer to fill out like a Social Security disability application, how would you bill for that, and what would the language be?
Well, that would be linking them with Social Security if you're helping them fill out paperwork. So that would be case management, mental health. That's in the rule and under the service reimbursement definition guide. I believe they have examples of helping them fill out paperwork for, you know, applications for Social Security or for a landlord, or that would be case management, mental health.
Okay, so there's an example of notes in there on the service reimbursement, you say?
It wouldn't be notes, but they talk about different activities that you could do that would be billable under case management mental health.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Our next question is from Scott Freed. Your line is now open.
Yeah. I have a question about the medical necessity. That's the first item you discussed, that every consumer for any services rendered, there must be a medical necessity for that. And my question is it always all the time that for every service you provide for your consumer, there must be a medical necessity before providing that service? For instance, I have a consumer that comes to my office and says, Mr. Godfrey, in my church every time, friends ask me for my email address, and I don't know how to use the computer. I'm so ashamed, I don't want to tell them that I don't know how to use it. So I accompany this patient to the library, show him how to navigate the internet and how to use the keyboard, establish an email address, the yahoo.com, and we did everything, and I explained to him too that in order to write and retrieve his email, he needs a password, and I coached him on how to do that. We established a password and everything. So he was happy and said, you know, when I get to church now, I'll be able to tell my friends that I know how to use the internet. So what is the medical necessity for providing this service for this consumer? I know I provide a community support service, but my question, what is the medical necessity for that service?
I just want to point remind you that the definition of medical necessity is in Rule 132.25. Yes. And so I would review that and become very familiar with that. Leanne had talked about the criteria for determining medical necessity,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's going to be reimbursed. The services have to be medically necessary. That's why we talked, for example, with the question about transportation. Just transporting someone from point A to point B, that's not a medically necessary service.
I agree
and
with
so,
that.
So become very familiar with that. And if you have any further questions about medical necessity, you can refer them to the Rule 132 mailbox, the DHS.DMH mailbox that was on one of the last resource slides. If you have a really specific question, and that sounds like it's extremely specific, it's DHS.MH@Illinois.gov. And that is a very good resource. If you have any kind of Rule 132 clarification questions, for you to go to that, it's a multiple agency group of people that discuss the questions that have been submitted and develop responses. So DMH is part of that call, DCFS, BALC, the collaborative, and IPI all meet together to go over the questions or submitted, and so that's an extremely good resource.
Okay.
And then you'll get a response, usually within a week, maybe 2 weeks at the most, directly to you, and then the questions that they received and the answers that were given are posted quarterly on the DMH website.
Okay.
And so you
can
go and look at what past question and answers were, you know, had been.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We have a follow-up question from Ted McLean. Your line is still open.
I need a clarification regarding the community support services. Is there like a requirement that the services need to be conducted within the agency, or is there a requirement that some have to be conducted outside? Is there like a percentage of the service that must be provided outside the agency?
I believe the rule says 65% of your community support is supposed to be outside the agency.
60%. Right. Yeah, 60%. Is that correct? Okay, so that's for individual, as group, as well as residential. Is that correct?
Residential is always on-site.
Okay. Okay, just want to make sure I'm clear.
Yeah, residential is always on-site. It's at the residential facility.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time, speakers.
there's any questions in the queue.
I'm sorry, do we have any more questions?
Yeah, I'm sorry. We have one question just came in. Let me check the name. One moment, please. We have a question from Robin Bentley. Your line is now open.
Hi, my question is about client goal wording on the mental health assessment. Wondering if the language we use for the client goal on the mental health assessment needs to exactly match the treatment plan goal wording.
The suggested goals on, did you say the suggested goals on the mental health assessment?
Yeah.
Matching the treatment plan?
Correct.
Okay, the goals and the objectives would be on the treatment plan based on the information that the mental health assessment contains. So you may have suggested some recommended goals or objectives, and then it would be up to the LPHA to determine if those are medically necessary objectives and goals as they sign off on the treatment plan. So, I mean, I suppose that you could have them on both documents as recommended on the MHA.
Okay. We thought that they had to exactly match the goal wording from the MHA to the treatment plan.
No, the LPHA would just need to determine if what's on the treatment plan is medically necessary and is a service that the person needs.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Next question is from Kelsey. Your line is now open.
Hi, I had a question regarding billing for an interview with a client that we may be screening for our program, to assess if their needs meet the program that we have and how we would go about billing for that service.
Well, you were just saying assess needs, so that's probably MHA. Because you're assessing their needs, right?
Right. The question we had, at some point we were told that we couldn't bill for services unless the people we were assessing were already registered to the Mental Health Collaborative, which is difficult for us to do prior to meeting with a client for an assessment. So is that true?
What was the question? I'm sorry.
Does a client need to be registered to the Mental Health Collaborative before we can bill for a service?
I don't know that answer. Do you, Chris?
Yeah, that is outside of our – if you want to direct that to the dhs.mh@illinois.gov mailbox, they would be happy to answer that question. That's outside of our area.
Okay. And then I also had a question about goals on the treatment plan. Do the goals on the treatment plan specifically all of them have to be from the client, or can you include goals? I mean, are those all spoken from the client, their goals, and then the objectives are ones that, a caseworker can add into?
The treatment plan is the person being served's treatment plan. And we have seen sometimes that treatment plans that are more treatment plans for provider staff. And just keep in mind that it's a treatment plan for the person. And sometimes we see, the problem with writing and, putting down what the consumer wants to work on may be different than what the staff feel the need is. For instance, maybe the person has a pretty serious substance abuse problem, and the person has said they're not interested in working on that,
mm-hmm.
Then we would not want to see that the staff said, well, so-and-so needs to attend so many substance abuse groups because they have a problem. If you see what I'm saying, it needs to be the person's treatment plan and their goals.
Right. Okay. I think sometimes we just have a difficulty with some of our lower functioning clients that have very personal goals that are difficult to tie with a medical need. that makes sense.
You can use your clinical knowledge to turn the goal to have. We've seen treatment plans that have had a consumer goal. I once worked with someone who, when I did treatment planning with me, he told me that one of his goals was he wanted to build a go-kart. And so that, of course, is not medically necessary. But as we talked to him more in depth and worked with him clinically, what he wanted to do was become more independent. And so we've seen some providers maybe have the consumer goal, which helps the consumer, and then alongside it or something have it in the language that, you know, that it needs to be seen.
Okay.
So, I mean, if it's something like that, but it wouldn't be just a provider staff person's different goals than
right.
what the
consumer. You can add an explanation of how their goal is.
Yes.
Yes,
using your clinical knowledge and in order to meet the Rule 132 requirements.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jessica. Your line is now open. Jessica, your line is now open. We're unable to hear you.
Hi, I had a question about your sample progress note for case management mental health, where the case manager reviewed the med chart and then called in a refill to the pharmacy and then called the mom and left a voicemail, and you're saying that's not a billable note. If staff are notified by the client that they need a refill and the staff member, like, reviews the psych console, the med history, and does that and then notifies the pharmacy that a refill can be granted, is that still considered not billable?
Tammy, do you want to talk to this, you know,
sure.
this question?
That actually came through the FAQs of the DMH mailbox, the Rule 132 question and answer. And they, it is under the questions and answer. It was last June of 15. I don't remember the actual date. The case management mental health is not a billable for refilling of medications. That's just cost of doing business, they said.
Okay.
And then if you're just leaving a voicemail, you're really not talking with anyone.
Right, right. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question is from Linda. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Two questions. The first one, just to clarify on the client's progress toward their objective. I know that all progress notes need to include the description of the interventions provided, the client's response to the intervention, and then their progress. But I'm curious because we have some clients where maybe their objective is due to their impulsivity, their objective is to not interrupt and talk over their peers during group, yet in the group, perhaps that day they were working on identifying coping skills. And so if we're writing their progress, are we talking about whether or not they interrupted during the group or whether they identified a coping skill, which happened to be the subject matter of that particular PSR group they were in?
I would say it could be either or. I mean, it could be both or either or, wouldn't you, Chris?
Yes, I would just say that it would be whatever the purpose for the participation in the group is for. That's what the note needs to reflect.
Okay, great. And then the second question is related to the fact that, you know, I'm in full agreement that the client's ITP is the client's ITP. It should be their goals, their objective. Where we have often just struggled with finding a way, especially to help other clinicians understand how to write a goal for client-centered consultation, which is a service that is provided to assist the client, but the client is not even present when it's being provided. So I try to explain to some of our staff that, you know, for all intents and purposes, it becomes more of a staff goal, that the staff will communicate with each other. So how to put that in a clinically appropriate way in an ITP? Because we know it has to be included in the ITP, but it really is not the client's working on something because they're not present when you're doing client-centered consultation.
So it wouldn't be so much a case management client center consultation goal, that would be a service under an objective. And so, say, for instance, the person had an objective that they were going to learn the three coping skills. Mm-hmm. Maybe the person needs to learn those coping skills in order to be able to go to the doctor because they're so terrified of doctor appointments. And so the therapist may be in contact with the primary care doctor to see how they're doing in relation to how they're managing while they're at the doctor's office. So it wouldn't be so much a client-centered consultation goal. It would be, you would have the service listed on the treatment plan for the objective that the service would be appropriate for.
Okay, so if we have it in, say, using your example, which is a good one, if we have that related under that goal about their becoming more comfortable talking to the doctors and going to appointments, would we then need to relist it under, you know, any other area, or can just having it once on the ITP would be sufficient to cover when post-payment review comes and they're looking at client center consultation services were provided, is it in the ITP?
Yes. It would need to be on the ITP if the claim is for case management client center consultation.
But it just would only need to be there once. We wouldn't have to list it under their objective
post-payment. My only other comment is that it would need to be with each objective that the service is the need is the need for the service. So, you know, if client-centered consultation is not needed for, you know, five of the six objectives and it's only needed for the one, then that would be fine. But for post-payment review, they're just going to look at a claim run and it's going to show that the service that the claim was for client-centered consultation.
Sure.
And so they're going to want to see a progress note for whatever number of units on that particular day.
And they want to see that service is listed in the ITP.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. If there are no further questions at this time, once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one. Once again, as a reminder, if you have any question, please press star followed by the number one. Thank you. We have a couple of questions in queue. Let me check their names. One moment, please. We have a question from Eileen. Your line is now open.
Hi. Just some clarification on the ITP review. So, originally, when you started the webinar, it was the ITP review should be done when you're reviewing the treatment plan, go through all the goals, objectives, interventions. A little further on in the question and the answer, you said that would be a good practice to do also if you were just modifying the treatment plan in between that six-month time. Is that required, or is it still only really required to do the full review of the treatment plan during that six-month time frame?
Well, the one that I was answering, they were going to make a new treatment plan. The person was going to go to a different, like to their crisis unit, apparently, where they do another treatment plan, and then they were going to do another one. So anytime if you're going to do a different treatment plan, you still need to review the previous goals, whether that's 6 months, 3 months, you know, because that's the way it sounded like to me. The person, they were just switching from one program to another in their agency, and that might be how they write their treatment plan. But anytime you're going to make as some people will call it, a new treatment plan, you have to review the previous goals. The only treatment plan you don't have to review is the initial when they first come for services.
Okay, so if I'm just, say, 60 days into a treatment plan and decide the person's going to go to PSR, I'm not creating a whole new treatment plan. I'm only adding that one intervention. I still do a full review of the treatment plan for all the goals and objectives.
Not if you're just adding a service. Your LPHA needs to sign it saying, yes, this is medically necessary.
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question is from Virginia. Your line is now open.
Yes, hi. I had a question in regards to the example that you had shown for case management. I think you used the example, I believe, helping the consumer with finding employment. You had mentioned that usually for case management, it would just be a description of the activity. And I was just trying to inquire, is there still an intervention that needs to be documented and it tying back to the treatment plan?
I would refer you to Rule 132 and all of the services that are listed. Case management, mental health, it's under each service in Rule 132, it's the last bullet point or whatever of each section, and it tells what needs to be in the progress note. For case management, mental health, it only needs to have the description of the activity.
Okay.
And so I would just refer everyone to look at those different requirements.
Yeah, because I think I was just going based off of the – I know you guys just had some samples, and so I was looking at that and just kind of seeing how we do our notes, and I'm looking at the 132 and just seeing the bullet points. So I just wanted to inquire because I know the way you had the sample was very generic, so I was just trying to inquire.
Yeah, I do just want to note that those are just samples, and like I said, those are kind of hard to develop at your desk. But
thank you.
Yeah, become very familiar with what Rule 132 says about what's required for a progress note for each service. It's very, very clear and easily understood in Rule 132.
Thank you. Our next question is from Michelle. Your line is now open.
Hi, I'm calling about a particular question from the standpoint of a biller. I was wondering, are there diagnoses that are deemed not medically necessary in community mental health?
That would also be a question that you need to refer to that DHS-DMH mailbox. The collaborative during post-payment review does not focus too much on diagnoses, but other people that will review you, such as BALC and accreditation, do. And so I would refer you back to that DHS.MH@Illinois.gov mailbox, and they will respond to that, and then everyone on the call will be able to see the answer in the next quarter or so.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question is from Wishke Shetty. Your line is now open.
Hi. I had a couple of questions. One of them is, when you're in the ITP, while you're listing out, do you have to list out short-term and long-term outcomes to every activity that we're indicating the client's in? And or does that mean that in the progress note, we have to put the short-term and long-term outcomes of the activity?
So are you talking about in the progress note or on the treatment plan?
Well, I'm trying to find out if it needs to be in both.
The treatment plan needs to have the expected outcome date or the objective, and then the progress note needs to identify what you're working on.
Okay.
And it needs to be able to be tied back to the treatment plan.
Okay, so the objectives within the ITP need to have your outcome with short-term and long-term.
The treatment plan needs to have the expected outcome date.
Okay.
It doesn't clarify short-term or long-term.
Okay. Because we have dates. It's just, it seemed like somewhere along in the review we were told we need it to have for each activity we need to list out. Within the ITP, we have to list out the short-term and long-term outcome. And we weren't sure because I didn't see that in the rule.
No. No, I don't recall that would be in the rule.
Okay. Okay. And the second question was, if a staff member does an ITP review, but the client's not here, and I think we answered this a few times, but if the staff is able to talk to the client over the phone and the client's just not able to come to the agency, would that be something that would be acceptable to do as clients involved in their treatment plan, or do they have to be present in the office?
I believe it could be over the phone if there's a reason that they can't come into the office.
That information would be located in the SDRG, and I would encourage you, I don't have that here with me. And then you can also ask it of the DMH mailbox. But does everyone know what the SDRG is, or should I explain about that?
Please, I definitely don't.
Okay. So we have Rule 132, and then what's called the SDRG is the Service Definition and Reimbursement Guide. It's put out by HFS,
okay. And
it explains in great detail about each service and what's acceptable and what's not. It also has examples. It also tells the billing units and how much the service pays. It's a pretty important document to look at, and it's kind of in conjunction with Rule 132. And both Rule 132 and the Service Definition and Reimbursement Guide can be found on the DMH website in the provider manual. If you go to their website and search for provider manual, it's under item 4 in the provider manual. It has the rule, the SDRG, and also the Rule 132 Q&As are all right there.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know the service definition. I just didn't know the abbreviation for it, I guess.
Good to have.
Another question was, this is partly with our QA stuff, and I don't know if this is the venue to ask it, but under the rule, I was trying to find anything that talked about billing review requirements or if agencies are required to review the billing. I know we do quality assurance, we do utilization review, but I don't see anything specific to claims. Is that not a thing, or is it included in the utilization review?
That's what post-payment review is about, but it's really important for providers to know what their documents look like and what their staff are doing to identify any kind of training needs that they need to, that their staff have, and to make sure that their staff are doing what they're supposed to do per Rule 132. So it would be really important to know, to do internal checks to make sure what you're billing is accurate, because you don't want to be suspended, for instance, during a post-payment review.
Yeah, we do them. I just noticed that the Medicaid requires 10% as the minimum for your per amount of charge you pick. I didn't know if there was a percentage minimum that they were looking for in claims, like you have to review 20% of claims that you're submitting. Okay.
I don't believe it's listed in the rule.
Okay. That's what I just needed. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question is from Cheryl Pugh. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. My question is in regards to the LPHA's review of the ITP and the MHA. Is it necessary to document that those documents have been reviewed, other than the signatures on those documents, but actually in the record, creating a progress note to indicate that you have indeed reviewed and signed off on the MHA and the ITP?
Tammy, do you want to talk to this question?
Sure. We looked at the LPHA signature. As Leanne was saying earlier in her presentation, she was talking about the signature of the LPHA is assuring that the LPHA has indeed reviewed the documents. You don't have to make a separate note. It's just that by that LPHA signing that, they're saying, yes, I reviewed this and I agree with it.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie, this is Amy. We're going to have time for one more question.
Okay. One moment, please. One question just came in. Let me check the name. We have a question from Christina. Your line is now open.
Hi. I work at an agency where I'm doing outpatient counseling, but we also have day program services. And I'm wondering, like, if I'm consulting with a QHSP on a client that I'm seeing, can I bill that as case management client-centered consultation?
Yes.
Yes?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I just wasn't sure because we're at the same agency if I would be able to bill for that, so.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
All right. I would just like to say that will conclude our call for today. I would like to remind everyone that today's call audio and presentation will be posted under the Provider Resources heading on the provider information page of the collaborative's website. The audio will be in MP3 format and ready for download within 1 week. I would also like to remind everyone that we value your feedback, so please take a few minutes to complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum today. Carrie, can you please push the speakers through to post-conference, and you may now disconnect the main line.
Thank you. One moment, please.